Hello, and welcome to the Learning and Development Podcast, presented by 360 Learning, a podcast that explores L&D that works with those who are making it work. In this episode, I'm speaking with James Griffin about implementing a skills-based learning approach. But before we get into it, if you're enjoying this podcast, please do give us a 5-star rating on your podcast app of choice to help others to find us, and thank you if you've done so already. Now, let's get into it. James, welcome to the Learning and Development Podcast.
Thank you, David. Great to be here. Really, really appreciate the invite and looking forward to today's conversation.
Great, me too. James, to begin with, perhaps we should start by unpacking why skills-based learning is gaining prominence right now. And I suppose it has been. This isn't brand new. Certainly for the last 5 years or so, it's been a priority for learning and development. But I'd love to explore with you what the broader context is and what problems we're trying to address with skills-based learning.
Yeah, well, I think we couldn't really answer this question without mentioning that kind of, you know, historical 5 years that's elapsed. I was on a call the other day and the guy was calling it the skills gold rush. So, you know, there has been a huge amount of momentum behind skills, a lot of noise, I think, a lot of confusion. I think it's put a certain amount of pressure on HR teams, and L&D are not are definitely a part of that. But I think if we focus specifically on L&D, the one reason I think it makes a lot of sense and why it's coming to the fore is, and I'll be candid, that L&D haven't always done a great job of being able to measure what they're delivering, measure outcomes, measure the value that they're bringing to an organization through the programs that they've so brilliantly designed. So I think that skills does enable that. Skills enables, through the use of skills data, more meaningful, measurable outcomes. Okay, so I see that as a real benefit to L&D teams. Okay, there's a fair bit of work that needs to happen beforehand before you can go in. And I know we're going to dig into that. But I think really if I think back in my career, I guess I'm quite relatively new to L&D. I joined one of the kind of largest LXP providers of the time through acquisition. And I came more from, you know, the talent acquisition, talent management side of the house. So when I went to my peers and my colleagues, and I said, well, what are we measuring in L&D? What are we measuring to determine that this program has been effective? And it was, you know, the KPI stuff, which is really typical. It was completions. It was hours spent learning. And that's just not going to cut it anymore. That in the world of massive uncertainty, where organizations need to be really adaptable and they need to move quickly, where velocity is also critical, being able to measure that somebody logged in and viewed some content doesn't tell you anything.
Yeah.
So I think that skills really now provide that data point, which not only enable you to get organized and design more meaningful courses, but enables you to measure that outcome. So I think that's a really important part. One of the other things that I think is important here is when we talk about those outcomes, like what are we actually building towards? So I've listened to, you know, some of your podcasts before, David, and I forget the name of the lady that was on, but she was talking about measuring business impact. And to do that, you really have to be able to understand what problem you are solving. And again, skills are a bit of a conduit to that. For example, if you are able to understand that you have a problem in cybersecurity, or you have a problem in information security within your organization, measuring a completion of a course will tell you that you've got a chance of actually getting better at that. But measuring what your stakeholders are measured by in regards to cybersecurity, it's going to actually give you some evidence that L&D have impacted the business. So I think that's a key consideration. The other part here is really, it's the vendors, you know, and I sit on that side, as do you. So, you know, I work for a consultancy, we sell services. You work for a technology vendor, you know, you sell software. So that skills gold rush, that ability to be able to organize around skills and talk about skills-based initiatives is now real, is now genuine. Yes, it's confusing. Yes, there is a lot of noise. But if enterprises get that right, and you know they choose whatever vendor they want to do this with, then the ability for them to be more efficient in the work that they do is now real. Whereas previously it was very labor intensive, there was a lot of manual intervention. You know, some of that has now gone away. So I think if you put those two things together, then you've got a really great opportunity for L&D to start to say, okay, we can provide a far better user experience with a measurable outcome that is going to solve a business problem, and we can do that using skills.
Yeah, really interesting there, James, bringing together some of the burning platforms, some of those real drivers for this. I think that that we can also throw into the mix that there is a maturation like here in learning and development. We've had learning technology for quite some time, and I think that we're probably moving out of the phase, hopefully we are, of just providing a lot of learning and thinking that simply by doing so and it being good, that by osmosis, by some way, without understanding what the problems are, that we are going to make an impact. But I think that operating with hope, fueled by an enormous amount of money and invested in platform, it's a bit of it's a bit foolhardy. You know, what we're talking about here is addressing identified problems, you know, speaking the same language around skills rather than providing for unidentified problems, regardless of perhaps what they are. But excuse me, James, I've got to bring my inner cynic out already here. I think this is born out of 25 years in this profession. And so I've got to ask you, how do you see a skills-based approach being different to previous approaches employed by L&D and HR, for instance, competencies, behaviors, and capabilities?
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion around this. And before I answer that question, I go back to what you said, like the hope element. We've got to remove that. Hope is not a strategy. I used to work for a guy and he used to say to me, "When are you going to have that thing ready?" And I'd say, "Hopefully by Friday." And he'd say, "Take the hopefully out of that." So it's not hope is not a strategy.
No.
We all hope that we do well, but we've got to be more targeted, and skills as the data set can really do that. But to answer that question around competencies, behaviors, for me, it's relatively simple. Skills, getting yourself organized around skills can be more dynamic. Okay, you mentioned competencies. Now, competency frameworks, and they still persist, are relatively static documents that sit on a C drive and people try to implement them. They use them for comp and bends, they use them for role clarity, they use them for a bunch of HR operations, but it's not particularly dynamic. Now, skills as a dynamic data set can provide you with a much more sort of evolving and up-to-date set of data that people are going to actually buy into. There is a big caveat here that I will get to, but I think that's the real critical element. If I'm a an L&D specialist at, Acme Enterprise, and I understand the skills to a role, like a skills to role mapping, then I know what skills are specific to that position, and they might be in the audience for the program or the curriculum that I'm designing. That's really valuable, let's be honest. That's incredible. You know, housed and configured in a system that can be updated at a regular cadence using artificial intelligence. So that is a world away from a static competency framework, which took 12 months to build and was probably out of date the actual day that it went live. So I think the dynamism of all of that is something that we shouldn't overlook. Now, that does sound like a lot of work keeping that up to date, and it can be, but the investments and the ROI on that are tangible. Okay, show me somebody who could measure an ROI on their competency framework. If I had a hat on, I'd probably eat it. I don't think it happened that often. So I think skills as a dynamic set of data, and the tooling that supports that is really, really relevant. The caveat that I want to put on that is skills on their own as a list of skills, and we hear people talk about that as a taxonomy. Whether that's true or not, I guess, is probably another debate. A list of nouns is not really what we're looking for. we need to understand what those skills are. Descriptions in natural language that people can interpret. Okay, and then on top of that, we need to understand the proficiency level that people should be looking to ascertain so that they can develop themselves and move up from a 2 to a 3, from a 3 to a 5, whatever, you know, proficiency levels you have. And again, those proficiency levels need to talk the language that people use.
Yeah.
When I get home from work and my partner says, "What did you do today?" I don't turn around and said, "Well, I actively listened to my colleague present our new service offering and I practice radical candor and empathy." It's just not how we speak.
Yeah.
We need to get to a point where skills have the right descriptions underneath them and the proficient. So that gives me as an employee an understanding of what I should be trying to develop. But the proficiency level tells them, how does that get put to work?
Yeah.
So within a role, what proficiency level do I need to be good at my job and reduce my anxiety and be more productive and increase my performance and also have visibility of an adjacent role or a role further down in my career that I might want to move into? So skills is definitely an important part of the story, but the proficiency levels are just as critical. And I think this is, my gut is telling me this is going to be the evolution we're going to see in 2024.
Yeah.
AI is doing a fantastic job to bring efficiencies and automation to some of those labor intensive tasks that have fallen on L&D or other functions within HR. And I think now we're going to see more investments in proficiency. There's some great innovations hitting using video to be able to practice your skill and have AI assess your proficiency in that skill through video. I mean, that scales. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's, The difference between skills and competencies, to answer your question, is really about that dynamic nature of what you can do with it. Behaviors are still behaviors. I don't see those changing. And they might manifest in an organization slightly different. They might be values. That might be something that, you know, an HR leader will propose to their workforce in a slightly different way. But, you know, people get really stuck in the mud on this. Skills, competencies, behaviors, what is it? Stick to something. You know, document how you made your decision and go with that. You can always come back to it later and change it if you need, but don't let it get in the way. Like, let's move forward. Let's not let perfection be the enemy of progress.
I think that what's so important in what you've said there is the dynamism involved. When something is printed out and sent around, and then that's the doctrine, that's the dogma, that, you know, that's when it becomes unworkable. I remember when I first joined Disney, there was a brand new competency framework that was launched from head office and made available to everybody. And, you know, in Europe, we supported 45 different countries and 14 different lines of business within it. I looked at the first competency and I could immediately see how that didn't apply to at least 70% of the workforce, because it tried to be everything for everyone and ended up being nothing to no one. And it was
to anybody. Yeah.
Yeah. It was totally unworkable. But as you'd said, that this it's played such an important role, because it talked about the integrated employee experience. We didn't use those terms then. It was more about the HR or employee life cycle, whether that was through recruitment, development, reward, everything was and performance was, everything was supposed to be aligned around it, but it was so restrictive that it couldn't be much more than just a cursory glance or nod. And you can imagine the conversations around it. James, did you exhibit? And then read it out, and you go, oh, I don't know, maybe. Well, let's not mark you down as hadn't, because we can't really interpret. And so, and so you can see how it becomes redundant. But you could also see how, and this is where I think that why I raised competencies, capabilities, and behaviours is those things you can easily get through an HR leadership team and an organization's leadership team to sign off on as a good thing, in the absence of what do you have in terms of definition and accountability for all of those things. So you can get sign off, but when it comes down to the nitty gritty, the implementation and the execution, to what extent is it actually making people's lives better, or are you just clogging it up with more bureaucracy And my own experience, like when I was working in finance and banking with behaviors, Disney with competencies, those land on your lap and you go, oh, for goodness sake, what we've got to do this nonsense as well as the work. What I love about skills is like you do this right, and you've already touched on some of the enablers that that we have now with the smart application of AI. Skills is the work. There is no
Totally,
distinction between the two. If you're talking about the skills required within any given context, the not just the role specificity, but also the context, like the industry or the job function that those are to be applied, and the proficiency, you're creating a path. Those are the
Totally.
breadcrumbs towards
And
proficiency.
it's measurable. I think that's a key point of difference between anything that was kind of framework based on a static document. Very hard to implement, as you said, not very practical, overwhelming for a manager, overwhelming. Like, you've got to do the work, you're accountable for your targets or, whatever you're being measured by. And then you get this competency framework. We need to understand everybody's capability against this. It's like, lip service, ticking a box, just doing whatever you need for it to go away. So no value to that person. If you think about the personal value to a manager with skills and proficiencies, is that we can measure it. And that is a real innovation. That's a real step forward. Yes, we can measure it with AI. And like I said, there's work to do on the proficiency side of things. And I think those investments will start to hit. They're already hitting, and we'll see, the manifestation of that in practical, capability and functionality and technology as the enabler, this year, maybe 2025. But that measurable element, if I'm a manager and I've got a team of people and I've got to assign work, oh, okay, I'm going to give it to David because I know he's absolutely brilliant at this because he's evidenced it and we have that measured. I know that. It's not just my biased point of view that I know David better than anybody. It's like, well, here we have the evidence to say that this work should be assigned to David. If you look at it through an L&D, well, how do we make more Davids? How do we get more Davids to the table so that my role becomes easier and, we're able to develop people on the skills that they need to get better at their job? That measurability is so critical.
Well, let's explore that a little bit further then, James, because there are going to be gaps in people's understanding here. Skills-based learning, it isn't new. Perhaps it's not wholly prevalent. I think I read something quite recently that said 10% of organizations are on this journey, which means that there are 90% not on the journey, perhaps lurking and seeking to understand more whether it's appropriate for them or just hesitating because they don't know what's actually involved. I'd love to know, perhaps if we start with the assessment, how do you assess an organization's readiness, James, to take a skills-based approach to learning?
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic, and in the work I do, readiness is a key component to. We look at that through an understanding of the maturity of the organization. Okay, so you could say, foundational level, intermediate, and maybe some sort of advanced, just to keep it simple, like three steps on a maturity curve. So to assess readiness, I think there's two key optics, two lenses that we should look through. And that's both the HR optic, like internally reflecting on HR as a function, your level of readiness, but also externally, the business readiness. How ready is the business? Where is the appetite for this within your organization? If you don't get both of those right, you're going to be down. I'm going to borrow from my colleague Gordon. He has this term he uses. It's probably not his term, but it's HR for you or HR to you. So is this HR initiative something for you that you can use? And we talked about the dynamic nature of skills and how that measurability is of real value to a manager. Or is it in an initiative where everyone's going to say, oh, here comes HR again. We're just going to have to pay lip service and we're going to have to tick that box. So looking at what readiness means, well, within HR, you've got to be honest. You've got to look at your capabilities within your function. And this is something we haven't talked about yet, David, but capabilities really are what skills enable you to build. So how does it, why are capabilities different? We see them as quite different. And we've got like two different types, maybe. You've got the organizational capabilities, that's you know, the policy, the process, the practices, the technology, the investments that you make in tangible stuff that enables the business to function. And then you've got the other side, which is actually the kind of less tangible stuff, and skills definitely play into that second bucket. Does HR have those capabilities to enable this? If not, then you might need external help. Mm. There's a little plug for myself there. do you have technology plays a key part here? Do you have the technology that is going to enable you to initiate a program on mm. skills? Now, when I say a program, you don't have to boil the ocean. We're not saying you've got to come up with some sort of skill development strategy that works for every single employee in your business. I would actually caution against that. I would say start small. Mm. I would say experiment. There was a great bit of research by Red Thread. I don't know if you know Red Thread in yeah. North America, a couple of years ago. And their message out of that was start, just start.
Mm.
Don't be afraid of failing and learning, because that is how a human learns, but just initiate something. So your internal capabilities within HR are critical. The ecosystem, that's technology, that's policy, that's process, that's everything that is going to enable you to get an initiative that has a chance of success off the ground. And then on the business side, have you engaged your stakeholders?
Mm.
Do you know what is keeping them up at night and how they are measuring themselves against that? Why would you not measure your L&D initiative against what they're being measured against? Mm. That to me just makes such common sense. So those two key areas of readiness are really, really critical. Don't just reflect internally, although that's important. You have to have an external viewpoint on what is going on in your business
mm.
and understand the readiness there. You will not find everybody advocate for skills. So don't go there.
Yeah.
Go to the people that do advocate for skills and work with them as your early adopters, your champions. Drive advocacy from them, and then get everybody else online as you move forward.
Mm.
So it takes a bit of time. You have to be pragmatic and appreciate that it's not going to happen overnight. It's not flicking a switch.
Yeah.
But definitely look through those two lenses.
Yeah, I love that. And that was certainly how I'd gained support for initiatives when I was leading functions. It used to be when learning and development or training and development used to be about delivering a course for it to then have the impact. The prevailing thought was that you'd run a pilot and you would have some people who are receptive, some people who are nonplussed, and some people who were perhaps more cynical to get their wider view. But what I found when you needed to make meaningful change is you went where there was appetite. So because you only got to walk backwards a few steps to realize that there's appetite because the status quo is less than desirable. So you've got people who are aware there needs to be a change. Perhaps they even understand the consequences of not changing or how mm. it's impacting the current levels of performance. So you help them to do what they're trying to do, but better because you've got that,
yeah.
that outside support. And then you're able to gain your confidence through your approach to actually do the thing that's required, the change that's required, and then see that's made the impact that you'd hoped for. That little incubator then helps you to refine your approach, make a meaningful impact, but also begins your PR campaign about the impact that you can have if there is a known problem, and then grow it from there. But certainly not go to a part of the business that isn't interested, that doesn't see the value you can bring, and then try to launch something because without an appetite, without there being a real problem, I suppose we're going to be in the same situation as ever.
You're just going to be banging your head against the wall in certain areas, and you're going to run out of energy. You're going to be shouting loud for a long time, and you'll run out of energy. Like I said, I think so there are some obvious places that I think where early stage skills experiments make sense. If you think about any organization, they have an IT department. They probably have software engineers. Most of them now have data scientists, data engineers, all that kind of stuff. Those functions have grown up for the last 20 years on agile methodologies.
Mm.
Okay, the concept of waterfall is pretty much redundant there, apart from in certain examples. that they typically are quite receptive to these kinds of initiatives. Understanding the skills they have is second nature to them. Okay, now they are very sort of hard, techno-functional skills. That's fine, but it is a great place to start. Another one is sales and marketing. Again, particularly in marketing, they are iterative by the nature of what they do. Campaigns go out, they measure the outcome, and then another one hits. It's a process that they're quite au fait with. So those are two areas where I think, to anybody listening to this, that could be a place to approach, your leaders in those functions. I call that a soft landing spot. Where's my soft landing spot? Where am I going to go where they're going to listen to me and we're going to actually be able to do something meaningful that we can then look to maybe scale beyond, the walls of that function. I would say don't lead with a skill. Don't say, oh, we want everybody to get better at radical candor, or we want everybody to get better at active listening. I would stay away from that because then you are going to be forcing that onto people. Go to a function and ask them the question, what is broken? What is keeping you awake at night? What is the biggest rock in your shoe? Or is it pebble in your shoe? What is the biggest pebble in your shoe that I can try and help you remove? And we're going to try and do it by using skills-based learning.
The opposite to that is what I think most organizations did about 10, maybe 15 years ago, trying to introduce courageous conversations. It was a skill set that was projected onto an organization, largely a panacea. And of course, it just didn't
It
work,
washes
didn't
up,
land.
it crashes on the rocks, right? You get a bit of momentum and the wave is looking good, but then it crashes on the rocks and then you feel deflated by that. I think reimagining that process of how you initiate a program is going to put L&D in a far better position for potential success. And you mentioned, you've got promoters, you've got those who are kind of on the fence, and then you've got your detractors. Why would you not focus on people who are going to promote it? Like you say, they become your internal voice, they become your advocates, they'll give you case studies. Clients of mine, we've done videos with people who've enjoyed success. That goes on the intranet, that goes on SharePoint, that goes somewhere else, and it creates noise. Enable those people to pull you along a little bit. Because if you keep pushing, it's exhausting and you will run out of energy.
I'd love to get to the nuts and bolts of this, James. I think that the listener's going to be convinced that that this is a good idea. It's what the leaders are talking about. It's what wider business is talking about. You can't read financial pages or business pages without recognizing that there are skills deficits, maybe even in educational pages of newspapers. It's indisputable. But what we're talking about is far more than perhaps the cruder approach that we might have been advocating for the last 5 years, which is shiny new platform, oceans of content, tag it, align it to people's roles, give them a report because these are the skills that are missing in your areas. Off you go. It didn't work. It can't work like that. It's a facile approach to a complex problem. So where should we start in terms of our own role in learning and development?
Well, I think it's important to remember here that the role, what is the role of L&D? I think that's an important consideration here. Now, that might change, from organization to organization. But if they take it as that they are accountable for the development of their employees, okay, so that's their role is to bring an employee, whether that's in the current role that they sit in, or whether that's in an adjacent role or the role that they might get in the future. So, talent readiness, et cetera, then I think you can start to see that the role is, I guess, it hasn't necessarily evolved. The toolkit that they have to do that is now, they've got better tools. They've got a much more meaningful set of tools by which to develop people. So I think L&D as a function needs to be brave, needs to be correct. You talked about courageous conversations, but they need to show courage. They need to be willing to take a little bit of risk and not just err on the side of caution, which is maybe what they've done historically, and actually put their foot forward to say, we believe that by looking at, skills-based learning, we can solve for X, Y, and Z, or we can move the needle on that. Mm. And like I said, and I'll keep saying it, measure yourself against what your stakeholders are measured by,
yeah.
and you will be able to evidence that. There may be a level of inference in some ways, but that's fine. Organizations work through hypotheses. We just need to be able to test them and be happy to say where we got it wrong, and just as importantly, celebrate where you got it right. So I think L&D needs to be, I actually thought in 2020, we know the world changed. You know, there was a great opportunity for L&D there to really amplify their voice.
Mm.
And in some places, I definitely saw that happen. But I think in others, the macro environment was too difficult for people to maybe, you know, to actually execute on the opportunities that were ahead of them.
Mm.
Now, the world has returned to some semblance of normal, although there is a constant theme of change and, you know, adaptability is critical. But I still think that, you know, we're now in a much more kind of structured place when it comes to our work-life balance and just what's going on in that way. So I think the opportunity now for L&D to be brave, to step forward to the plate and say, we can do this, is genuine.
Yeah. I completely agree. I think that that what we saw in 2020 with the shift to remote working was that that learning and development aligned to the biggest priority of the organization, which was setting people up to perform wherever they were working, and then supporting line managers in managing productivity, general performance, without all being in the same location. It was that that beautiful moment of alignment. But yeah, likewise, I've seen that we perhaps strayed off track, which as you've just said, like, skills is that opportunity to align again with the biggest priority. And we've talked a bit about the technology here. I think that the last 12 months, James, I'm sure you'll agree, has seen learning and development, or organization just in general, opportunity to actually address, to understand the skills in their organization, take huge leaps. Learning and development are notoriously small teams with vast populations to support, not just diverse in terms of the job function, but also in terms of geographic spread. But there are AI tools such as Skills GPT, which is available in the ChatGPT store, which can help to create dictionaries of skills, understand from the actual organization's perspective what those skills are in context, and then talk about the proficiency as well. So it can help you to get down into the nitty-gritty, not just of the skills, but the skills in that organization, which are aligned in the context of that organization, and down to proficiency, which does close a lot of gaps. Again, that's weeks, if not months worth of work that is dynamically available at our fingertips. I wonder to what extent you're seeing the partnership here between learning and development teams and generative AI now in making skills mapping so much more accessible.
Yeah, it's an area where I personally have been working quite a lot, particularly through 2024, through 2023, and now as we're into 2024, it's absolutely true, and it's not weeks and months, it's years that some of these more manual processes would have taken. It's a bit like, for those of you outside the UK, you might not know what this means, listeners, but painting the seventh bridge is a phrase that we use in the UK, because once you finish it, you just got to go back to the beginning and start again. Okay, so, you know, that is not a process that is sustainable and doesn't have value to an organization. So yes, automated or AI driven skills technology is extremely prevalent, and it is hyper efficient. It enables you I've seen systems that can deal with, you know, hundreds of roles in like 6 seconds. It's incredible. That is great. That gives people, I believe, a starting point, okay? And that enables them to start, like we said before, just start, just get something going.
Mm.
What I think, there is a note of caution here. What I've seen with my clients is that within your sort of core functions within an organization, so, you know, legal, HR, finance, sales, blah, 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 those types of AI solutions do a fantastic job. Genuinely, they do. And you will put you, what you need to do is you need to validate the AI with your people leaders, and you need to get that in front of them and say, can we have a response? Maybe workshop it with them. You could do that virtually if you're lucky enough to get in a room. You could do that on a whiteboard and say, how close are we? Is this does this make sense to you? And then you've got that proficiency conversation as well. What I have seen in very specialist areas, in very specialist areas of R&D, or maybe in medical industries or in scientific industries. So if we take a sort of analogy of the AI solutions can be quite broad, and maybe they're kind of deep, maybe puddle deep, if you like. Whereas some of these specialisms in an organization go very, very, very deep. Okay, so will the AI provide the level of integrity of that data that's needed for those specialisms? Okay, so that is a question that I think HR need to keep at the forefront of their mind. That is not to say, by any stretch of the imagination, that AI is not useful to every organization, because everybody has sales, everybody has HR, everybody has legal, finance, all of those core functions. Fantastic. We can get through that work really, really quickly. But then when it comes to our deep specialisms, do we need a different solution there? Maybe not. Do we need to a more manual intervention there? Maybe so. Okay, so just be careful with those very deep specialisms. I've unfortunately been on the other side where we've prevented some AI solutions to, deep specialist people managers, and they've kind of torn it to shreds a little bit, and then they've come back with their proposal. Okay, so just a little note of caution there. But the value that it's offering around, those core functions is brilliant. You can stand something up in a heartbeat, if you like. It still needs policy behind it. It still needs, some governance behind it. You do have to lock something down and say, this is what we're going to go with for now, and we will iterate on that once a month, once a quarter, once a year, whatever you decide, whatever's right for your business. But yeah, absolutely. The solutions that have been hitting, and they're only going to get better, right? This is a trained model. Okay, so maybe these off-the-shelf AI solutions are great for core functions now. Maybe in 2026, they're going to be able to handle every single specialism, that we can find. But I don't think we're quite there yet.
Yeah, it's Donald Clark that says it's as bad as it's ever going to be. And the way you've described it there, James, reminds me of the phrase that's going to help the most cautious person. Remember, AI is your co-pilot, not your captain. And if you hired the smartest person in from outside your organization to develop you a skills taxonomy, ontology, or dictionary, without working at your organization, if they got it 80% right, you'd still expect there to be some manual work on top as well. That's with the smartest person, but you've got something that's far more efficient and pulling from so many more sources, as you said. This does this in 6 seconds. You're still not going to publish it and then take this as gospel. You're gonna take this as an incredible start that you couldn't possibly have done yourself in anywhere near the time, but you're not
Totally.
going to take it as gospel.
No, you're gonna spend some time engaging your leaders there and say, let's let what's your response to this? How does this look to you? And that gives you a great way to engage them, to get them to start to build some buy-in and build that consensus that this makes sense for their business. Maybe they're the detractors, and you've got a bridge, you've got an initiative or some work that they can help you with that actually brings them back to the table, and they can take a little bit of ownership of that as well, because they've got skin in the game. And you mentioned 80%. I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? Like, you've accelerated 80%, if you like, or you're 80% closer to where you think you need to be. Let's not fixate about the 20%. Let's give ourselves the time and the environment to close that extra 20%, but let's celebrate the 80%, because that is a long way from where we would have been if we were still talking about static documents on PDFs that people have got to go and interpret and then use within their reviews and their coaching and all those other places that those things land. So that 80% is a huge win. It's massive.
And you know, so it's one thing to have a skills taxonomy ontology, you know, that's alive and accurate, but a huge part of any skills endeavor has got to be the assessment of current level of skills and tracking the improvement. What's your approach? What do you think that we as learning and development need to bear in mind in terms of our expectation of what's possible and perhaps some pitfalls of oversimplified approaches?
Yeah, again, assessments, I think, are another area of focus, I think, for innovation budgets through this year and beyond. There's a lot of different ways to assess things. You could do a self-rating. Okay, fine. You could get your manager to rate you. That doesn't really take into account any relationship challenges that you might have with your manager, which could be biased. You could ask for a peer review, so somebody that you work alongside. There are AI solutions hitting here. Like I said before, the use of video, which is enabled to assess somebody against a set criteria, which like video to text innovation, they scale, really well. But I think the way to assess people is in the work that they do. So if we've got the proficiencies against the skill, we've got four levels, and they're worded in a nice natural language so people understand genuinely what it means. It should actually kind of look like the tasks and the outcomes that you should do in that job. That's really what a proficiency should be. So if you want to assess somebody well, then I think you should be assessing them in the work that they are doing. So don't try and bring that into a process where they're assessed more naturally within the deliverables that they're measured by. And if they are good at their job, then their skills by virtue, by proxy, are good as well, right? Would you agree?
Completely. But which brings me nicely to, I suppose, one of my final questions is, how do we in learning and development hold ourselves accountable then for whether this is a success? I know that that we are not that far from good learning and development being the provision of a comprehensive learning offering. Then you have a self-directed learner. That was nirvana, really. That they would learn, they would get better, and if they didn't, perhaps they're not learning right, or they're not applying it. But what we're talking about here is coming much more together to where an employee is assessed by themselves, by employees, by AI, whatever it is, and a more as we possibly can, a rounded subjective measure, or as objective as we can be, and then helping them to do what it is that they're expected to do. So if we are successful with a skills-based learning approach, are we saying that we will hold ourselves accountable to people actually doing the job, or even perhaps having a deeper, richer talent pool from which hiring managers are able to get future or current employees? What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's an important thing I haven't mentioned so far, and I think this is the right time to bring it up, that skills are not the end game here. Okay, skills just they're just not. The end game is something you said earlier, is and you just kind of said it again in a different way, is increased performance and productivity that enables that individual to be successful in their job, that enables that team to be successful within their function, that enables that organization to win within their industry. That is the end game. Okay, so should L&D be accountable for that? Absolutely. Why on earth not? The problem that I think persists is that we are not yet, or some organizations are, they talk about human capital, their people being the most important asset in their organization, yet they do not measure them in the same way that they measure other assets that they have on their balance sheet. They will know, Amazon will know to the eighth degree what their stock inventory is. Okay, a real estate organization will know exactly the yields they're getting on all of their properties. Why do we not yet view people And I know it may sound like we're commoditizing ourselves a little bit, but why are we not looking at return on an asset for an individual? And this is something we're really passionate about here at Skill Collective, is that we're looking at ways to measure individuals, and by proxy the team and the function, whatever, based on monetary value. And if we can put those tools in the hands of HR functions, including L&D, then you can say, well, yes, we spent £2 million last year, £10 million, whatever it is, but this was the yield that we returned. And then L&D can be accountable in a way that they have really strong evidence to show. So I hope that answers your question. It's not maybe direct, but I absolutely think L&D need to be accountable in that way. We know we need to solve business issues and approach our stakeholders to find out what's keeping them awake at night. We know we need to then develop learning that is going to solve that problem. So you can measure it on the yield of the skill, or you can measure it on the outcome for that business leader. So there's kind of two ways there, I guess.
Yeah, and I think it takes a boldness to do that. Again, learning and development don't need to a lot of the time, but personally, I think that when tough times hit and we're in a tough time, if you can draw a direct line between the investment in learning and development and a deeper, richer talent pool and people more able to do a job, because you were involved in conversations and solutions, I think that shores us up. You know, I speak to learning and development leaders who have increased the resources available to them during tough times because they are able to demonstrate their value. And I also speak to others who have asked me whether they think it's an inevitability that during tough times that learning and development is shrunk. I always answer the same thing, which is if you don't know to what extent you're delivering value and whether your spend is equating to meaningful impact as determined or defined by your organization, then you should always feel precarious, not just perhaps during tougher times. But James, as we look to wrap up the conversation, there's a lot that we've covered in here. We've said that it will take boldness because organizations might not be banging on L&D's door and telling them to change. But if the listener likes what they hear, how would you suggest that they go about beginning their skills-based learning journey?
I think reach out to someone within your organization who you know well, you have a good relationship, you know, start somewhere where you've got that foundation to build on, and ask them, you know, what is the biggest problem that's going to prevent you reaching your objectives in 2024 against what you are currently measured against? And then look at that and break it down and say, how can learning help this person solve their problem? Start small, be realistic, try to prove and validate. It's almost like the kind of tech startup, you know, sort of ethos is, you know, validate, you know, minimum viable product is almost what you're talking about, and validate that, and then look at where you're going to go next, and where you're going to go next, where you're going to go next. Do not let perfection be the enemy of progress. Don't be afraid to fail and learn. I'm kind of saying a lot of cliches here, aren't I? But they're all very, very relevant. And don't view the technology as the entire solution. It is not. It is not the silver bullet. It is the enabler. The solution is everything that's wrapped around it. It's the policies, it's the processes, it's the practice, it's the people. But you know, tech is important, and I would imagine that a lot of organizations within their ecosystem have probably got technology that they can experiment with just to prove something out, come up with an MVP, build the business case, evidence that return on investment, and then look at where they go next. They've probably already got that in place. So don't get distracted by a lot of noise in the marketplace and a lot of heat that may be coming from your vendors to say, oh, we can do this, we can do this, we can do this. Like, choose the ones that are genuine partners and then work in partnership with them to prove out that MVP, and then look at how you scale beyond. I think then you'll have the data, you'll generate the data that evidences that it's successful. You'll build the consensus internally that this makes sense for the organization, and you'll stand a better chance of being able to scale that up, you know, through through further initiatives. So that would be my suggestion.
Brilliant. I love it. And James, if the listener wishes to follow your work or connect with you, how best can they do so?
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn, James Griffin. I'm at a company called Skill Collective. That's probably the best spot, or james@skillcollective.co.uk.
Wonderful. And we'll put links in the show notes. But all that's left for me to say, James, is thank you very much for joining us and being a guest on the Learning and Development Podcast.
Fantastic. I'm disappointed it's over so quickly. We could have talked a lot more.
Thanks, James.
Thank you so much for having me, David. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to today's episode presented by 360 Learning. Skills-based learning is a huge opportunity for L&D to align to business priorities and make meaningful impact. With the right implementation, approach and technology, we can become confident in our ability to close skills gaps and achieve far more than we could possibly have done so just a short while ago. If this conversation has whet your appetite for good quality L&D chat and you'd like to get involved, you can now join the L&D Collective, of which I'm an active member. Join me and thousands of L&D peers via the link to the L&D Collective in the show notes. And if you'd like to get in touch with me, perhaps to suggest topics you'd like to hear discussed, you can tweet me at David in Learning and connect on LinkedIn. Again, you'll find links in the show notes. And goodbye for now.